for coming, everyone. So yes, like Kedric said, I think most of you kind of or know me or know a little bit of what I do. And I would like to preempt this talk with a disclaimer, which is I'm just a working class cosmologist. So I do the kind of stuff that you do. I work a little bit on inflation, constraining different models, single field, multi-field. I've worked on optimizing constraints of the CMB. I've worked on dark energy phenomenology. I didn't work on modified gravity. I've been part of a large survey, so SDSS. I was part on the Lyman Alpha Forest, and I've worked on the optimization of surveys for DESI. So this is to say that I'm not coming from theory, la-la land. That, you know, it is I actually have, sometimes the feet are on the ground, and I know just how much I'm asking from you guys with what I'm going to propose. So let's start. This is work with all the work in here is with Lee Smolin. And then we've got this bunch of collaborators over the years. And I guess we just start going straight into it. So this is a list of assumptions that is, I think it's more true of quantum gravity theories. Laurent, you can check, rather than cosmology, but because the models I'm going to propose are quantum gravity and cosmology, we had to build them together. So time is an illusion in the sense that it's not a fundamental quantity. I suppose this is a very common assumption that space and time emerge from an underlying description in quantum gravity. So time, particularly, doesn't exist at the Planck length. The equations are supposed to be timeless. And when it emerges in the effective description, it's the parameterized equations that are symmetric under time reversal. And then this is the part that might be connected to cosmology. The time asymmetry of nature is an accident. So it results from the improbable choice of initial conditions. It's effective. It's not a feature that's deeply embedded in the buildings of physics of nature. And so basically what I'm going to say is that's not, it's, everything is the opposite of this. I did choose those sentences so that those are the ones that I'm going to deny. So this is work that started with Lee in 2012 or 2013. We've had these couple of papers are kind of seminal. One is for classical version of the models we propose, and one is the quantum. I would like to say half quantum because it's not exactly the emergence of quantum mechanics. Then we made a correspondence with spin foam. We worked with Enrique Gomez and Andrew Little on extending GR to time asymmetry. So you add a term. This is a correspondence of our model and the dynamics of the model to another well-known model that also describes the emergence of time symmetry from time asymmetry. And lastly, has been a lot of fun. This is the last work we have, two papers on retrocausality and time asymmetry in quantum mechanics. So I'd just like to know who here, other than from me, has heard about retrocausality. You heard it from me. Okay. Okay, good. So because I don't think I will have time to talk about this, maybe I should go to the quantum foundations or quantum information people to talk with them, because it's a lot of fun. So but basically, this the talk is just going to be the intro, and I will explain the energetic causal sets. And the intro is going to be long, and I've given it before because, like I said, I am asking quite a bit from you guys with this introduction. So this is a standard slide. We in physics we are doing time symmetric dynamics, standard model, GR, fluid dynamics, all of our physics at the microscopic level, atomic physics or at atomic level, is all time symmetrical. Then we all discard half the solutions of the equations of motions from our theory because they are not observed in nature. And these are examples of everybody, you have all heard of all these examples of arrows of time. So I want to talk about this slide, which I was going to ignore, but it's because it's so obvious that it's when we describe it, it becomes a bit more helpful. So electromagnetism is one of the examples that of time asymmetry that we discard. We don't consider the advanced potentials, and the retardation in electromagnetism is not really just a feature of radiation. It's also in the equations, Newtonian equations of motion. So if we described a system like this, which is just a stone falling in a pond, the theories that we have, everybody accepts, they admit solutions in which the reverse would happen. So you start at the bank, at the margins at the bank, the degrees of freedom in the bank conspire, they start vibrating, they go to the center of the pond, and out pops a stone. So this is a theory to our equations, to our equations that are under consideration. Personally, I find it's a bit unsatisfactory. So what do we say usually? Initial conditions, right? Everybody in the world or in the scientific physical community is doing their experiments, carrying out research in their fields, and they say, well, I don't know about initial conditions. This was just before the system started, so I don't need to worry about that. And Feynman, in 1973, said, well, today, initial conditions are really not a part of physics. One day, studying how those initial conditions came to be might be considered part of physics as well. And when I heard, this is on a discussion with Fred Hoyle that is available on YouTube. You know, first I thought, well, actually, yeah, that's true. Now we consider initial conditions. But actually, I don't think that today physicists consider the initial conditions of their own fields. There's one particular group of physicists that actually is in burden with that task. So the pile under the rug of all these initial conditions that we rely on to do our time symmetric theories, it keeps adding on, you know? Everybody shifts it backward a bit until the point that the pile is really big. And it's all very nice to place it on the boundary conditions, except for a group of physicists who are going to pick up the bill. This is us in cosmology. So you could say that we're paying for for everybody's free lunch, because everybody's doing time symmetric physics in their fields. You don't have to work. You can carry on with the beauty and the elegance of the symmetries in your particular field, and you don't have to worry about why the other solutions, the time-reversed solutions, are never observed. You just put it on the pile of the cosmologist's work. And then I just added this here because I'm not sure with the quantum mechanics problem of the measurement paradox whether they are blaming it on initial conditions or not. So maybe we are not paying for their lunch. So let's just have an idea of how big is this problem that we've been asked to pay. And I like this little story because it gives us a good idea of just how enormous is the initial conditions problem. So traditionally, cosmologists work like this. In the traditional view, early universe is a hot plasma. There are 10 to the 80 baryons. There are 10 to the 8 degrees of freedom, so photons per baryon. That's the in natural units, this is the entropy of today. And so at the early universe, you have the total number of degrees of freedom are these, and so the likelihood of the early universe is 1 up to this number, to the exponential of 10 to the 88. So if this is all the whole story, today we would live in a cold plasma of 3 Kelvin. And so the universe would look like this, and not like this. So if the gas, the hot gas, was all the amount of degrees of freedom at the early universe, we wouldn't have galaxies today because there are no gravitational degrees of freedom that we are looking, counting at the early universe. So we want to count the gravitational degrees of freedom as well. Nobody really knows what is the number of degrees of freedom in gravity, but we do know it for one case. And so there's a little difference in the thermodynamics of gravity, which is different from thermodynamics in a gas. And the maximum entropy in a thermodynamical system, in a gas, is achieved by a completely homogeneous distribution. And that's completely the opposite of what is the maximum entropy in a gravitational system. So the gravitational system, is the collapse of all the components. So with clumping of matter, with the clumping of the matter in the gas, the entropy goes up. With the clumping of matter in a gravitational system, the entropy goes up. The gas goes low, and for gravity, the entropy goes up. So gravity has specific heat. It cools down with clumping, whereas a gas heats up with clumping. So this is a little calculation done by Roger Penrose, and you just assume that there's a black hole type Sagittarius A, like our black hole, at the center of a galaxy. So the galaxy has approximately this amount of solar masses. And then if you know that there are about 10 to the 100 or 12 galaxies in the universe, so you spread that the entropy of black holes amongst all the baryons, you get 10 to the 21 degrees of freedom per baryon, and the entropy today is that. And then the likelihood of the Big Bang will be 1 in the exponential of 10 to the 100, which is a little large. And after I wrote this slide, of course, we got our fantastic image over there. Actually, this changes a little bit if all the galaxies had such a massive black hole as that one, as the M87, the entropy would go a little bit higher per baryon because you're more of the masses of the mass of the galaxy is collapsed in the form of a black hole at the center, so the entropy will go up, and that's more or less the exponential. That's the likelihood of the Big Bang, given by the exponential of the entropy. Oh, sorry. So, did we ask for this problem to be given to us as cosmologists? I think I asked the question the other day, and I got a positive answer, but I'm going to ask it again, which is there any cosmologist in the room who became a cosmologist in order to solve the initial conditions problem? Two? Oh, very good. Okay. Well, then I think we did ask for this mess.
Why did you go into the field and help to solve that problem?
Oh, I didn't go. No. I wanted to. Okay. Well, I don't think that this is an easy problem to solve. Of course, I want to know how the universe came about, but I don't think that's the reason that everybody comes in.
Isn't that the same problem?
How the universe came about? Sure. But that's not the only thing that you come for cosmology.
Isn't it?
I don't know. Ask the rest of the only you.
Give me another reason.
You want to know what the universe is made of. How did it evolve?
Much less interesting.
Okay, Neil, but then you could ask the audience as well, because there's only two arms raised.
Well, which is where you go to quantum gravity.
I mean, you want to know where, how it works out?
Sure.
You want to know the condition on which, so.
Yeah, yeah. So you're thinking that we should all come to quantum gravity. Okay, so one of the things that I
we're at the stage where we can all work.
Hello, I'm giving you a talk. So one of the things that I think is a sign of having this unasked for problem is that solution, the kind of a botched solution by the community, it comes easily in the form of something like this. And I'm not going to say anything else. Draw configuration space. Okay. So if the proposal instead is that, actually, I don't feel like drawing this, sorry. Do you know the configuration space of a system, which is a phase, a momentum, and a position of all the particles in the system is usually a six, dimension six times n, the n being the number of particles. And so the explanation in entropy, I am going to draw it because it's difficult. The explanation of why is the entropy so low at the early universe is it's something like this. Imagine this is squares of different macroscopic states, and then some squares are bigger, some squares are smaller. You can just pixelize everything in here. This, because, so this is usually something to x and something with p. This is the largest volume in configuration space and could be, so the state of the universe today has all these, as all those possible microstates that all yield the same large microstate. And then the problem is that we want to understand the same for at the early universe, you've got the same configuration space, but then there's a tiny corner there which has the likelihood of one in the exponential of 10 to the 100. And you have to explain how did it get there from the macroscopic state by reversing with time reversible laws. So the idea is that this might be difficult to do with time reversible laws, but the proposal is that if you instead reverse the universe with time asymmetric plots, it might be that you don't end up in such a low entropy state, because as I explained, we get passed on a little of the burden by all fields in science, which just shove it backwards and backwards onto them, onto the initial conditions. So this is kind of saying, let us all share democratically the burden of initial conditions through by proposing that the underlying laws of physics are not going to be time reversible anymore. Yeah?
There's a joke you're making here. If you go back to what you were saying earlier, it's not directly connected, what you explained before is that
if you just look at the matter stops in the time of space. So it is. So just that there's a difference between matter, degrees of freedom, and gravitational degrees of freedom.
Yeah.
So the matter, degrees of freedom, they start where they should. They start at the end of the thermalization process.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the time asymmetry is not really that you need a time asymmetric physics. You need somehow something that distinguish gravity.
Oh, you're talking about ways of counting degrees of freedom, changing that way. This is just, probably this is not even visible very much, but I don't even subscribe to this random path in configuration space very much. But this is usually the argument that is assumed. The evolution of a microscopic system is essentially a random path, and there's some evolution laws in configuration space. So the microstates that correspond only to one macrostate are very rare and special. Regions of large entropy have many, many microstates which all correspond to the same microscopic state. So,
and if you just look at the matter, that's where the universe starts. It starts in the most probable.
Sure. So, but I don't want to get caught up there, because the claim is going to be, instead of everybody pushing back and back the little bit of initial conditions that they don't want to explain, we could start by saying, well, maybe if we start with foundational laws which are time asymmetric, then we could get somewhere else. This is, by the way, nothing, not even close to this result. And this is quantum theory. I'm not going to go through this because I want to actually get to them, to the work. So why can we afford to say that the standard model of physics is time reversal invariant if everything around us is saying the opposite? What's the pillar that supports our time-symmetric physics? This is one of the biggest arguments, which I would love, and it would convince me if it were true. It's called the fluctuation dissipation theorem. It's a result of statistical physics and condensed matter as well. So it's a theorem that you start from microscopic, purely time-symmetric equations, and you bring those into an arrow of time or an arrow of thermodynamics. So from some fluctuations that have no preference of sign, you bring a fluctuation that has one clear, distinct direction. So it quantifies the relation between the fluctuations and the response of the system to a perturbation. So there you have a system in thermal equilibrium. You apply a perturbation to the system by some external influence in a non-random way. Either you compress it or just put something by hand outside. This influence is going to couple to the degrees of freedom that are immediately coupled to it. and it generates gradually a state of new equilibrium in the presence of the source. So initially, the fluctuations exist in both directions, and dissipation, which emerges, has only one direction. And I find this perfectly satisfying. If this was a sound theorem, I would be convinced, fine, we have our, everything is symmetrical at the microscopic world. When we go on and we can derive an arrow of time when you zoom out from onto macroscopic worlds. So, and the problem why this doesn't work is so trivial that it is difficult to understand. And this is the reason. If you apply a perturbation onto the system, which the system does not apply back in a spontaneous matter, so you're going to measure a response of the system from a cause, from an action that you've have implemented, you are already using the second law of thermodynamics, which is essentially the fact that a cause comes before the effect. In a purely time-symmetrical system, cause and effect change direction all the time. So you can't start from a microscopic, you can't say that you're starting from time-symmetric microscopics if the first thing you do is applying a perturbation which has only one direction. So this is another way to say it. The system cannot have a memory. If the system has a memory, there's a direction of evolution that you can watch. It's the same thing as you're watching a movie and you know the direction of time. So it turns out, I wasn't aware of this, that every proof of the fluctuation dissipation theorem, there are several, introduces some sort of irreversibility by hand. So something that starts, the cause comes first, the effect comes after, this is never returned. It is never derived from deterministic time reversible equations. It starts from the grand canonical distribution. I'm not going to go into this right now, but the system responds to the source after it has been applied, and not before. So the arrow is being already introduced. So I don't think we can say we have this explanation. And I found this quote by Tony Leggett, who's quite a fantastic researcher. He was a Nobel Prize in 2003. And basically, he won the Nobel Prize for condensed matter. But he argues that you can't derive anything useful for condensed matter from microscopic time-reversible equations, and that it is essentially a myth that you can derive one from the other. This is an excellent article. If I've got time, I will talk a little bit about this, because I think it's quite profound. We are all reductionists. And I think these guys in condensed matter have got something more about physics that we cannot get to by reductionism.
Can I get both quotes from the same article?
No, I think this quote is from this article. I don't remember where I saw it. But sorry. So this is the article. Do you know? Have you read this article? It's just a simple article that he explains a number of things. It's quite radical for something that's been written already in 1992. Is quite nice. So end of the introduction. There's no way, or I argue there's no way to find an arrow of time. We are asked to pay a large price. There's inconsistencies in the theories that we bring. These are large prices to pay to keep time symmetry. So maybe we can try and drop. this assumption that the world is time symmetric. So let's go back to the basics, and this is really something that I'm interested in. So I obsess about the origin of irreversibility. I don't understand it. I don't think we have a good explanation for it, and this is basically what I do and what I think about. What makes time tick? It's like there's something that makes time always evolve that I don't think we have captured. I believe we don't have a theory of time. When we write equations, beautiful as they can be, they admit the time-reversed solution. This solution is never observed in nature. I've got not comfortable with this. So this is the work that started with Lee. There's a funny story about this winning of the Buchalter Prize, which was they send you an email day after Christmas or something, and this guy Buchalter, never heard about that, and the email says, "Congratulations, you've won $10,000. Give me your bank account details, and I'll send the money to you." And I said, yeah, this guy in Nigeria is just trying to get, now the next thing he's going to say is, give me $2,000 first so that I can give it to you. So it was a few days that before I realized, no, let's go and check this out. Lee had even not gotten it. It went straight into the spam folder. So if you're a cosmologist, I mean, sometimes it's worse to check if someone is offering you money.
And sorry?
Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean, that name meant nothing, absolutely nothing to me. So these are the principles that we propose to solve some of these things. The paper's called Unique Events in the Universe. So cosmology is the only subject in physics that does not have copies. We only know how to do physics by truncating several subsystems, getting a lot of them, studying them, and infer laws. Foundational cosmology, which is basically what I'm going to be talking about, we only have one system. We don't have subsystems. In reality, we really do it as subsystems because we have CMB multiples, we love the Stripe 82, and so we actually do the same. And then from these truncated systems, we extrapolate to the universe. So why is this important? It's because it's going to end up in proposing the multiverse. It's kind of an argument that we get to the early universe, there's only one copy. How do you do science of a system that you only have one copy of? There is no scientific method for that. So this answer is kind of, well, I only have one copy. I'm going to imagine there are a whole lot of other copies, and I'm going to explain the properties of my copy based on that distribution and of the other copies, which we know many of our friends work hard on. The unique events is basically to state this, that there is only one universe. The explanation of properties of our universe as a function of additional non-observable universe is not a discipline of scientific inquiry. Yep.
So Marina, do you then posit that the observed realization of CMB fluctuations are derived from some fundamental principle, and that it's meaningless for us to talk about statistics of the CMB because we do posit likely a function for the CMB that it's
I agree with that.
Realization.
Yeah.
The possible many realizations.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How does that fit in?
So you don't have to. I guess that's the same question that you ask at the initial conditions. You see the initial conditions of the universe and you ask the question, what other initial conditions could there be? And so when you study the CMB, it's the same. You imagine that, you know, if there, we can imagine all the space of CMB fluctuations that there could be. So that's not ill-defined, and I completely agree with that. But you don't explain the CMB by saying, oh, it could have been like this and like this and like this, and not, it's not like this because, so you don't, you just consider what is its position in the whole distribution of possible functions. So this is the first thing. Then what are events? So we're gonna think of the universe as a network of events. This is basically a pre-geometry space, just a causal structure. You think of events as connected to all others by relational properties. So it's a view of each event views the other, all the others by their connections, by their relational properties. And what I was describing in terms of subsystems is that in cosmology or in standard physics, we take subsystems that look the same and perform our scientific method onto them. There's an interesting argument that actually Lee now claims he no longer knows who proposed this, because we talked about this a few years ago and I went back and said, oh gosh, I don't remember. But it's basically that the uncertainty principle from quantum mechanics comes from taking subsystems which look similar. You sever the connections of the system with the surroundings, and nature gets confused because, of course, the surroundings of the subsystem in quantum mechanics are very important. So you kind of could get, if you wanted and worked at it, you could get a fuzziness which reveals the uncertainty principle by the systems not being exactly similar and all the connections around it making a difference to how that system looks. So let's move forward. What are events? Each of these events, we're just gonna call it an interaction. I call it an interaction because it's the only thing that we, interactions in physics are the only things that, at least from my opinion, we are certain about. The evolution of a particle or of a wave function, which is never observed and doesn't interact, for me, that's more dodgy. So interactions is safe ground, and we are going to call, so each of these little red dots are interactions between massless particles. This space does not have geometry. It does have energy momentum, so there's no space-time. And instants of time occur every time there's an interaction. Time moves forward, and it moves forward irreversibly. So it's by saying an event occurs and it never disoccurs or it never unhappens. That's the instance. These instants of time are the fundamental elements that you're going to build physics from. So basically, we're going to have interactions which have two incoming particles and two outgoing particles. These are just null lines because, for simplicity, they don't have any mass. And we are starting, this is our starting point, has only causal structure plus energy momentum. And I think, Lohan, you're the only one here who knows where this is coming from. From what was it called? Where is the energy momentum and relative locality? This is your theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You don't not have us in the past.
No.
Okay.
You need Feynman diagrams. This is just a network of interacting objects.
Okay, so we're almost getting to the math stuff. The last thing that I'm going to say is there are four principles that we're going to build a model.
So, quick question.
Yes.
You talk about energy. But normally at the time, if there's no time transmission symmetry, what's the energy?
That's a good...
So...
That's a good question. Let me...
So why do you introduce energy?
Yeah, but there's time reversal symmetry and time transition.
You can't have time reversal symmetry if you don't have time transmission.
Yeah, but I think... I think they have time
about one moment in time.
No, but I think they have time translation symmetry. They don't have time reversal symmetry.
No, but then you can't have one unless there's a special moment.
I will have to.
We only have reversal symmetry about one moment.
Oh my God, my time's running out.
That's
a good question. I'm just going to pause it for now. And I will talk about it because my time is running out. But I think it's very good. Now, I'm just thinking whether you could have energy without conservation of energy. But so two principles. So time is not emergent. This is the second. Time has a directionality. Fundamental laws evolve from the past to the future irreversibly. They don't have an inverse. The second two principles are based on given the dynamics of the system. The system has a relational point of view. The space-time properties arise from relationships. Energy momentum is fundamental, as opposed to other views in quantum gravity. It's not emergent from space-time. Principle C gives us our wanted result that events are unique. Irreversibility means that events can never unhappen. And I'm going to spend a couple of minutes, because this is the work that Lee and I have been doing recently, that you could call it, this is very obvious, but if something from quantum mechanics, someone from quantum mechanics were here, they would probably have heard of this transactional interpretation or two-state vector formalism. Yakir Aronov works strongly on this, and so their claim, which I'm not going to have time to explain today, but it is really that events do unhappen, and that's a solution for solving some pathologies in quantum mechanics. Right, so establish the principles. I'm going to give the dynamics of the events and the dynamics of the causal structure to see what everything that works. So at each event, you have two incoming momenta, here and here, and they go out. That's a zoom in on the network of events. Each red dot is an event. Nothing particular about this. Now, we're going to impose some constraints at events so that the whole thing makes sense. So there's conservation of energy at events. There's no, we don't want there to be any redshift. So between events, space doesn't curve or you don't lose. There's no redshift. And then you've got, since we're talking about null lines, you've got the energy momentum relations. And so then you make an action, and the action, since we don't know anything about it, it's purely constraints. So these are made of a form of constraints of each event, which are the conservation of energy. And then we've got the no redshifts and the massless photons, the null line intervals for each pair of events. And we're going to extremize the action subject to this constraint. So we're going to use Lagrange multipliers, which are already there. And so now, what's next? You use the action principle. You can't vary the action by the Lagrange multipliers because you just get constraints back. So you vary by the momenta. There's incoming momenta and outgoing momenta. You get these two equations. If you add the constraint of the no redshifts, you get this simple equation here, in which the z's and the calligraphic n's are just Lagrange multipliers. And if you look at it, it looks like it has a structure of a space-time interval proportional to momentum, and you've got a fine parameter, which is a proportionality, and is usually along a null ray is arbitrary. So these z's are going to look like they are take on the role of space-time variables. And that's how you're going to get Minkowski space-time, because we are in the no redshifts constraint from the causal structure and from the energy momentum addition.
So
Were those some momentum of four vectors, or what?
The momentum are four vectors, yeah.
So those live in some, and usually momentum points in the direction of a trajectory, right?
Yeah, but he has three.
So how do you identify?
As an energy in three,
yeah.
And three spatial components.
Right, so the spatial components, I mean, then there's some identification between the possible space of momentum vectors and space, and actual space, right? So how does that arise in this picture?
Would you be terribly upset if I explained that later? I'm just looking at the time.
Okay.
I don't want to, I'm not even getting to the nice stuff. So then this is just a small derivation of how you would build relativistic particles from this, the same reasoning, the chain of events. You consider there's a chain, that there's only one single and one outgoing momentum. You get no redshift, and then you kind of have going to add these discrete events. The chain of discrete events are essentially going to become continuous as you take delta t to zero. This is the action you get, and then when you make delta t continuous, you get the action for a free relativistic particle. Sorry. So that's the end of the dynamics at events. And this is right now where the important things are going to happen. The events, what was the dynamics of the events, what happens and how did they take place, and now we're going to give dynamics to the causal structure. Which causal structure do we have? And so this is going to be selected to, again, have every of these events, every of these characteristics. There are no similar events. We just choose two parents and two children, could choose something else, but we want to be simple. That what event is going to happen is going to be a function of what is the number of events which are available currently that constitutes the present. We're going to compare all the pasts of those events, and we're going to choose the two events to interact to give the new event that is going to proceed in the causal structure. So basically, what you're going to do is, these events over here are the present, so they have fathers and mothers, but they don't have children yet. And when you then, to compute the next event, go and compute the past of each event, compare them all, and the two most similar are going to interact to give a next event. And so this is the computational algorithm. We choose an initial number of events, pick the pair that's going to create the new two events, which of these lines are going to interact. This is a bit more technical, but we added a stochastic component there, which is going to give the reversibility, and you compute the coordinates of the new event. So you just create two null lines that it's going to meet, and then repeat. So the first step, and I think this is the last one, yeah. The first step, if we want to propose fundamental time asymmetry into and to be underlying our model, standard model of physics, the first step is to show that it can coarse grain or can give emergence to dynamics which are time symmetric, because then we can go on to try and build the fundamental standard model. So these are the result, the simulations. This is Minkowski space-time. We've simplified to 1 plus 1D, because I'm lazy. This time is in that direction. X space is in this direction. This space has periodic boundary conditions, so it just wraps around like a cylinder. You can choose the complexity in the system, so by how many events do you have initially, and they're going to create a family, each of them, so each event is going to have a lineage, and the colors of here in the plot are given by, are giving those different lineages. And each event in this plot, plot is an event. Its dot in the plot is an event. So what is the important result here? We are starting in early times over here in dynamics, which completely disordered, irregular. You could say that this reflects really no structure, and the dynamics here is time asymmetric. Now we let time evolve, and something starts to change. Events start to organize.
Sorry, when your particles hit each other, what happens? They
just continue. So they exchange momentum and then they just, you just prolong their null lines. So the null lines are not represented here. These are just the dots at which space in the Minkowski space are the events taking place. So this is the interesting result, which was not built in. It's a result of the model, which is we see that after enough time has passed and we've given enough time for the disorder and time asymmetry to become exhausted, we see the emergence of these regular lines, which are no longer look like they're time irreversible, but they look that they could be approximated by something which obeys time symmetric laws. And so we call this a phase transition, and it's the emergence of quasi-particle trajectories. This is, so just to compare, this is another simulation with the exact same parameters, so to see, give an idea of the variation in simulations. Then we try to see, okay, does that happen for all parameters? So if we include a lot more complexity into the system, which is the number of families, there's so much complexity that the lines almost don't appear. So if you increase the number of families of complexity, you have to also increase the number of the number of steps that the system takes to run. So with the long time of computer simulation, then you do eventually get the emergence of the same time symmetric dynamics. So I think I'm going to go to the conclusions. And Neil, that's you. This was going to, I'll spend just 2 minutes. This was going to be preempting the retrocausality work, which was caused by one of the collaborators of Yakir Aronov coming into this discussion we had in 2016, and he claimed that in quantum mechanics events do unhappen, and that you get retrocausality because of that, and this is a way to save time symmetry in quantum theory. So I'm just going to go all the this, and I'm going to conclude. Sorry. Okay, so this is a small summary of energetic causal sets and what we like them. We can bring the flow of time, the one-directional flow of time, down into the foundations of cosmology. We get space-time emergent from pre-geometry, a causal structure, just with energy momentum. This is the puzzling or good result, which is we are able to get something that looks time reversible by strongly time asymmetric, time irreversible behavior. And this last one here, it's a part of the retrocausal work, so it's not really, I can't talk about it right now. So this is some of the ideas we have in mind. We can include space-time curvature to derive GR from the same, it's already embedded in the constraints. We have a quantum version that I have not described here but that quantum version does not yet have time asymmetry, so we want to do time asymmetry in quantum mechanics as well. We can include massive particles, which right now is only no lines, and we need to do the simulations for 2D and 3D that I'm not, what do you call this, lazy to do. So if anyone has a student that would like to do this, this is perfect work for a student. And this one I'm quite interested in. You all know the thermodynamical connection to GR, that famous article by Ted. So we want to start from the causal sets and derive the first law of thermodynamics. Not the second law, but the first law at least. And so these are the conclusions which are not related to the energetic causal sets and that I'm convinced about. There is no explanation for the origin of irreversibility in nature, in my opinion. I can't be satisfied. This might be a clue that I've been thinking about, which is a criticism, or not a criticism, but limitations of reductionism. We've been reductionists for 300 years. It might not be able to explain all math, all physics using reductionism arguments. Some phenomena resist reductionism views. So, like we've seen the emergence of the thermodynamical arrow, the quantum measurement paradox is also a problem of reductionism, or can be viewed like that. So it fails when we cut the connections of the system with the surroundings by reducing the system too much. And this is the view of Tony Leggett, which is really quite strong. It's very shocking for me. So he argues that irreversibility, or the arrow of time in macroscopic physics, might not be able to be explained by from simpler principles, from microscopic equations. So he claims that maybe we need to view irreversibility microscopically as fundamental, so not derivable from microscopic equations. And he means that it is as fundamental as we consider particle physics to be fundamental. I was quite shocked by this. I'm still thinking about this. I can't wrap my mind around what this really means. But it just says that, you know, when we go to the microscopic regime, there's something that appears there that cannot be explained in the terms of anything which is simpler. And so George Ellis, by the way, also shares this view. If you go to Pearson on that meeting, you can see his talk. And so these are called usually the top-bottom approaches. And this is the last slide. I think what might be happening here is our sense of taste and aesthetics in physics. So I like this. Oh, is there? Yeah, and a few kind of. It's correct, right?
Yeah, it's true.
So in Dutch, physics is called study of nature. I like this term because it reminds us what is the business that we are in. We are not in the business of studying mathematics, and it's very irresistible to kind of trail away behind mathematics and kind of and say, oh, please, please, nature, be like this, because look, this is so beautiful. And so mathematics is elegance, simplicity, symmetries. When nature agrees with it, it's the biggest gratification we have as professionals. But that is not to say that when nature does not agree with it, we let our sense of aesthetics dominate and go on insisting, no, you need to do this the beautiful way. So we are, I argue that we are the scientists which have the sharpest sense of aesthetics, we like for our theories, and it becomes, because of that, more pressing to check our convictions when we are doing building theories. I mean, we ask, sorry, what have I done? Sorry, just one more. We ask religious people all the time, right? Check your convictions. Do you think that's really proved by science? Or, you know, we say that we are very impartial, but there's a sense of aesthetics that we need to look out for when we are building and proposing new models. So that's it.
Important to distinct in terms of this question of to what extent does the second law follow from the microscopic laws of Newton's metric? I think it's important to distinguish between two different probabilities: one which you can't derive, and one which you can. And so I wonder whether 20 legged maybe getting confused about this. I mean, so the first question is whether you can derive DSDT, the derivative of the entropy with respect to time, is positive.
Mm-hmm.
If that's conditioned only on the fact that the laws of physics are time symmetric, and there you cannot derive. But the, you know, I think the when we're talking about the driving the second law, what we mean is, can we derive that DSDT is positive, is DSDT positive today, conditioned on the fact that we know that S was lower than it is today at some time in the past, not in sufficiently recent past, since it's not had time to reach equilibrium. And that, I think, you can derive. So I think that's the thing that is right. And so I would say that that appears to be, you know, so that appears to be the observational situation we live in. We seem to observe that there was lower entropy in the past, and we seem to observe that the microscopic laws, to the extent that we've tested them, they have turned out to be time symmetric. I mean, it's not just the fact that CPT is satisfied by the standard model,
yeah.
The fact that we are not aesthetic, those are both two tested theories.
Yeah.
So this, to me, the situation is that given taking as a sum these two things that we observed, that the entropy was lower in the past, and that the laws are time symmetric, that you can derive that the DSDT today should be positive from STAT-MAG. And so to me, the thing to be explained, the pressing thing to explain, is why the entropy was lower over time, not why the laws today might be time asymmetric. I think there's evidence for one that needs to be explained. I don't see evidence. It's possible that it might turn out that the laws today are time asymmetric, and we just haven't detected any evidence of that.
Gosh, I'm going to maybe take one part of the question and just answer that, and then we can discuss more. So the evidence for low entropy in the past, it's very subtle. A lot of the times we derive the low entropy in the past because we reverse the current macroscopic state using time-symmetric laws. So it's not the same as, you know, in biology, we uncover fossils, and, you know, that's the past. That's, you see the fossil right there, how, in the present, in your hand, how it was. In physics, that's not the same thing. It's like we don't have copies, fossils, of the early universe lying around. We infer it. And I mean, we all do it, and I'm not posing that we drop time symmetric laws because we don't know anything else. But it's having deriving the earlier universe low entropy by reversing using time symmetrical laws is not the same as actually, you know, digging up a bone and see an observation directly of the past in your hands.
But to make it more concrete, instead of going all the way to the past, let's just use our memories instead of memories. So we remember earlier times. That's more analogous to the fossil example.
Yeah.
We have these fossil memories of earlier epochs that were lowering.
Yeah.
And so I think of it as not similar.
Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, of course we remember, unfortunately, we remember, because if we didn't have memory, then we didn't need to say that we lived in a time-symmetric world, and we could all go on living nicely with our work. So I think you're right, and what you were saying is, you know, look, we have evidence that there is time asymmetry in the world, and I completely agree with that, unfortunately, because what I want is to understand what is causing that time asymmetry. And so what is, you know, how does nature know to at every point you have this quantity that's always ticking forward? It's like that, I don't know, and I don't think we do, and it's such a difficult question to pose because you can't pose it without, we have no way of asking questions which doesn't evolve some kind of evolution that time is passing. So what I think you're saying is there's plenty of observations of the second law and that the state was of the early universe had low entropy. Completely agree. And what I want to do personally is really track down the source of that asymmetry. Is it all the way back in the early universe? Does it happen right now? You know, I would shut up if somebody came up with a clock and measure the system in equilibrium. And so see, oh, look, this clock goes forward and backwards. The system is in equilibrium, so there's no time. And this is difficult. I don't know of a way to build a clock like that that measures the absence of time in a thermodynamical system in equilibrium. But that's my question. It's my kind of need.
So your simulation, could you explain what was time irreversible? I guess I didn't follow the details that the monk has found this.
Oh, so the time irreversibility of the system is just given by the fact that we just put some stochasticity in the evolution.
So where was the stochasticity? What is that?
It's in the generation of each event. So it's most of it is deterministic, and then this is a problem that I invite you to do sometime. How do you put irreversibility in an equation? There's very few ways, and stochasticity is one of them. So when you choose each event, the two events that are going to create a new event, you have to choose which of the null lines of the current event is going to be used. And I just choose that
so
randomly.
Two things that coming in, two coming out. So what is the stochastic exactly?
So there's, it's easier in this view. There's these guys here. These are the present.
There.
These guys are the present.
Right.
Now I'm going to generate the new event. I choose this and this guy. And
can you just point? It's
point very faint.
We don't see where you're pointing.
That one and one of those, they don't yet have null lines. Because we are in boundary conditions, we can choose the right-going null line of this event and the right-going null line of that event, or we can choose the left-going of the events to choose. It's just putting, you could choose 100 ways to put some irreversibility, but that is enough to create this mess over here. So nothing is regular. Everything happens asymmetrically, no structure, and then somehow the system kind of coalesces to this.
By activities, we have conservation of energy and
At the events, yeah. Yeah, but this is a part of the model which decides of all the causal structures at the events where those laws apply, which causal structures are we going to use?
So if we go back to the ripples in the water, would you say that apparent irreversibility is due to the fundamental, the more microscopic physics being irreversible already, or is it like just like it was saying here?
Yeah, I don't know. This is a model of that places the irreversibility down in the foundations, in the quantum gravity model. Tony Leggett has something more outrageous in which he says that cannot be explained in terms of something simpler.
So if it's this fundamental microscopic irreversibility, then that means that the usual reversible equations that we use to describe the systems are somehow not completely accurate.
Yeah.
Right? So then there must be some deviations, and given that those deviations lead to such dramatic effects, we might think that we would have observed those deviations also in other situations outside of thermodynamics.
Yeah, so if you put the time irreversibility in the quantum gravity regime, and then you derive, you coarse grain or zoom out to the standard model of particle physics, and then you go from there up. That's one approach. I'm very curious or puzzled by this other approach that it cannot be derivable. Condensed matter physicists, they know something that we don't know. Okay. We don't like to be convinced about that.
It's our job. They have a
Okay.
You know, when there is a solution, clap.
Sure. I welcome if anybody has any help.
No, I'm surprised as a cosmologist, you're not looking to the large scale structure of the universe as a determining factor in the era of time. Because that's what's special about gravity. It doesn't allow a thermal equilibrium.
Yeah.
So there you have it. There's the solution. It's just every solution.
It doesn't allow thermal equilibrium. No. What if the all the galaxies collapse in a supermassive black hole?
Then you're in.
That's thermal equilibrium.
That's a flat space. We don't live in such space.
No, if the initial conditions were such that the galaxies, you know, in the infinite future, are going to end up in a black hole. A black hole is one of the thermal equilibriums of gravity, right?
And what space is the black hole?
In all the space that other black holes are in.
No, I mean, there is no solution with just a black hole. Asymptotic space.
That's a good point.
And if there's no such solution, it seems to me that the solutions of cosmological solutions of GR are naturally happening. That is telling us somehow that when we really understand quantum gravity, but it's large scale, it's not small scale.
No, I completely agree with that.
Somehow.
I think that's very connected. Yeah, I agree with that. That's very connected. The problem of having only one system to study in cosmology is very connected to the very large scales and what we observe with resulting from gravity. Because let's face it, if there was no gravity, we'd still be just a CMB. And so what happens because of gravity might be very connected to what happens when we, you know, try to reduce the system a lot and find quantum mechanics. Yeah.
The only thing that related to what you're saying is that when you look at you know, demonization, there's different timescale that could be involved. Right? Think about the gas systems, it's all living. So here, with gravity, the difference between matter and gravity is really the time scale. So, you know, to get the plasma to triple in seconds and minutes, really that's the beginning of the universe. Now to create a supermassive black hole that englobe all the galaxies, which is what we're doing, well, you need 10 billions of years. So isn't that also some kind of natural explanation? There is thermalization going on, and, but of course they don't have this, the same speed. So then the question is more about why do we have two completely separate speed of thermalization, one which is gravitation.
Only two?
Well, the two we, at least two, the two we witness. One is the matter, which is short, and then, and then the other one is gravitational, which is, you know, exponentially larger than the
And then you have nuclear interactions as well, which is the reason if if there was, if stars don't appear, then everything would probably have collapsed already. So that's another degree of freedom.
It's driven by gravity. I mean, this is your scale of gravity. Thermalization is very, 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 very slow.
So Roger Penrose was saying that the entropy is really, really difficult to study because you have to. You can define it in whatever different ways you want, and I agree with that. And I think the first thing that we start off when we are looking at a system is which degrees of freedom are in that system, which interactions are you wanting to count, and then some of those interactions can be associated with degrees of freedom. Gravity cannot yet, only in one case. So entropy is very hard, and I think it's quite a difficult topic that I think is just fascinating, and everybody worries about it.
So I have evidence against your...
Okay, so nobody is hungry, essentially.
That thing is that I'm actually remembering from the future that Kendrick is going to say it's time to...
Yes.
go to lunch, so that's the retro causality.
Oh, but you will tell me the question.
No, I'm remembering Kendrick.
Oh, okay. So you saw that I was already going to say that.